You know what's a lot more fun than thinking about how to best pay off student loans? Thinking about how rich you're going to be one day in spite of your student loans. That's why we started the Financially Free Era podcast. Financially Free Era, if you search that term on any podcast platform, you're going to find it. It's hosted by my colleague Megan McGuire over at SLP Wealth. And this podcast is where we dive deep into all the things you want to know about how to be wealthy one day. How do you best maximize tax loopholes and write-offs? How do you best invest money? How do you make smart money moves in spite of even a very large six-figure student loan balance that are going to get you where you want to be much sooner? Go follow the Financially Free Era podcast wherever you listen to podcasts. I promise you, if you like Student Loan Planners podcast, you will love Financially Free Era by SLP Wealth. Search that term, follow the show, you will love it. Hey all, welcome to an episode of the Student Loan Planner podcast. I've got a really special guest for you today. I'm really excited. It's my guy, Stanley Tate. What's up, Stanley? How you doing?
Chilling, travel's good, man. How you feeling?
It's good. What's your YouTube so people know that? Because they should subscribe to you too if they're on ours.
Stanley Tate of YouTube.
Stanley is one of my key guys that whenever something wild happens with something terrible with student loans, there's a small group of us that text each other and we're like, yo, what the heck is this? What is going on with that? Stanley and I actually met in St. Louis back in the day when I was there. And we just happened to be kind of, I think, working out of that same building that I was in.
We were both working out of the same co-working facility over there in Central West End. We didn't know it until we randomly bumped into each other. So,
yeah. And we were like, I was like, what do you work on? He's like, student loans. I'm like, oh my gosh, that's what I do. But, you know, Stanley's a lawyer. Stanley, you often are taking on cases, you know, even sometimes like adversarial kind of actions against like creditors and trying to negotiate things for those, right? So, but yeah, you help more than just that.
Yeah, exactly. So I started off as a consumer bankruptcy lawyer, and I realized we're not really solving student loan problems. So much like you, we offer one-on-one consultations, but then also we offer the done-for-you service on top of that. And then sometimes there is proactive litigation where you're suing a lender over a thing, but usually we're doing that inside bankruptcy. Or then we're negotiating settlements for people outside of court. Or then sometimes we are representing people who have been sued over their student loans and saying, okay, let's figure out how to handle this. What is statute of limitations issue? Something along those lines.
I realized back in the day how complicated this stuff is. Because I remember like some person was in New York City or something. And it was somebody that worked in like the hospitality industry. And she hadn't made a payment in her student loans in many years or something. And like I checked with somebody. It was probably like Jay or Adam or somebody like that. I forget what the details were of the case, but it was basically kind of like they had passed a statute of limitations or something along those lines where they lived. And if she made a payment, it would like restart things. And so the people that had bought the loan from the other people that, you know, got rid of the loan were like desperately trying to get her to make a payment so they could restart the statute of limitations or something like that. I'm not a lawyer, right? But it was just so sneaky and so like tricky. And I've heard all kinds of interesting conversations whenever we hang out at conferences with you guys where like people are like, y'all talk shop and you're like, you know, why is this lender trying to get this client to do XYZ? And then somebody's like, do you know the statute in so-and-so state? Do you know that the lender is not going to be able to get anything from this person, but like they want them to do XYZ so that they can restart all the litigation? It's like, oh my gosh, man. You know, if you're in that situation, you know, talk to your counsel, right?
It's amazing how complex it is because even with like a statute of limitations thing, people are like, oh, it's my contract or I live here. It could be incredibly more complex. It could be where the contract was at. It could be the choice of law provision in the contract. It could be where you made your payments. Or it really could just be, I live in X state and this state says this rule, so that's what it is. But you don't know until you dig into it and you get all the facts, which is why like I find this work incredibly interesting because it's so complicated and it's so vast in like the things that you touch, right? Because as you know, a lot of times with our clients, we're not just solving a student loan problem for them. We're often helping them move on to another phase in life, whether that be a different career, whether it be buying a home, whether it be getting married or whatever. And so we get to touch on all these different things and have very real human connections with people, which is really cool because you help brilliant people who are absolutely befuddled by student loans.
Like I like to think of us as like student loan plumbers. Like we fix really messy situations. You know what I mean? Stuff people don't want to be touching sometimes. But let's talk about, so like to preview kind of what I was thinking about we talking today, big kind of highlights of today I was going to hit up with you or PS LUP battles. That's topic one. Second is basically like the pay, save, forbearance mess. And like, when are you going to people have to deal with that, and like what's going to happen next with the transition with those plans into the wrap plan. I thought we'd talk a little bit of IDR recertification. And then if we still have time, I thought we would get into negotiated rulemaking a little bit to talk about what might be coming down the pipeline. For the first thing, man, PSLF battles, right? For those that don't know, the Trump administration put out all these new PSLF rules, right? And predictably, they were, shall we say, interesting. And they immediately got legal challenges by consumer groups. How worried do people have to be? What are these changes that they're trying to make? And like, or do people need to be panicking?
At my core, I'm not a panic person. So I don't lend myself towards that. And when I look at what's happened, we have this announcement from the Education Department, well, from the White House, then filtered down through the Education Department, that we want to get rid of these illegal nonprofits with substantially illegal purpose, whatever that means to them, which really means you're doing something we don't like.
Right.
And now they're implementing it, and they just come out and said, yep, we post a rule for review, and it's going to go into effect next year.
July.
Right. How scared should someone be about this? If you look at it from the impact it could have, which is, let's say, Donald Trump and the Education Department look at California, the state, as an employer and says, you know what? No, we think this entire government is for a substantial legal purpose. Then that could wipe out hundreds of thousands of people from PSLF. And it wouldn't get rid of their credit already accrued, but it will stop them from earning new credit at that employer. Wouldn't stop them from getting new credit at a different job, but then they would have to change jobs, and who wants to do that? So is that scary? Absolutely. But should I be panicking about that? I don't know that I would be, because I feel like with these lawsuits that have been filed now by three different organizations, we're going to see some pushback there and likely see that this will be declared an illegal act. Just because if we back up, PSLF was passed by a bipartisan effort without condition by Congress. Like, if you are a nonprofit, you qualify for this thing. And then you would have the Education Department under this particular administration somehow trying to invalidate that, where the IRS hasn't even done it themselves and said, because I think that's an easier solution. The IRS doesn't think they're a valid nonprofit organization and don't deserve that designation, then go through that process. But instead, you want to try to backdoor your way through this regulation, which just doesn't feel right. And so that gives me like where I'm like not as panicked about it.
Yeah. I mean, I guess this one to me kind of feels a lot more like a PR thing than like an actual thing. Like, I don't know. That's just my instinct on this, right? Because the things they called out were
gender affirming services.
Yeah, exactly. Immigration. Like illegal immigration and like things that like, are you going to be able to say that like some big hospital system is doing these things and all the employees lose access to PSLF? Like, I think what they're really trying to do is try to coerce or force organizations to not do certain things or like and influence behavior.
We've seen reactions where people have maybe curbed certain services or there's been concerns. And so, yes, I agree with you that this feels more like we're taking a stand that this dangerous left has gone too far with this kind of whole gender thing, and we're going to put our foot down in this particular manner. And it's one of those things where even if you look at what they're saying, the number of organizations they expect to be found to have engaged in substantial legal purpose was like less than two handfuls. And put in context, there's 1.8 million 501c3s registered in the United States. So that's just out of that particular group, not is what you expect to find. Like, who does these changes for that? Like, in what other economy are we doing something that is such a minuscule issue, and yet we're trying to raise it up to be something that's super loud, and it's a problem that we have that's rampant across the United States? How?
So I guess some of those PSLF stuff that I would like to see is just more clarity on some of the rules that the Biden administration did around PSLF, like kind of in like 2023. So I guess the thing that I'm thinking about,
limited PSLF waiver and
like weighted average credit, for example, like if you consolidate, you're supposed to get weighted average credit on PSLF, and that's still currently the case. But in the weighted average consolidation rules for non-PSLF, that was in the save plan rule, wasn't it? Theoretically, the PSLF credit, you're still getting that weighted average credit if you consolidate at the moment, I think.
That's correct. So to back up for the audience, there are three different ways we use weighted average. One is weighted average for your interest rate when you consolidate. Then the other is if you have existing PSLF credit on your loans and you consolidate those into new loan, then you get the weighted average of credit on your existing loans brought into that new loan for PSLF credit. Then there was, and that was under a different rule that was made. And then you have income-driven repayment forgiveness credit weighted average. That was part of the SAVE plan rules, which would have given you a similar credit towards the 2025-year forgiveness if you consolidate it. It would not reset the clock. But that particular rule is caught up in SAVE plan injunction, and right now we just don't have clarity about whether that will even survive and you'll get that credit. So the approach that we are taking as consumer lawyers, at least the ones I've spoken with, is, hey, borrower, if you consolidate, you're likely going to reset the clock for IDR purposes, but you should keep the credit for PSLF purposes.
Right, which, I mean, you know, a lot of people don't know for sure that they want to do PSLF. They think they do. There's always like this little bit of doubt in their minds, right? Like, oh, I might go back to private sector or something like that.
Some of that doubt is also fed by just worry that the program itself will be there, right? And so they don't trust it, which is a strange place to be at because there's a lot of people who actually don't really have a choice that they have to pursue forgiveness just because their income kind of says that's the case. But just that lack of certainty that something that you are planning for will actually be there when you need it, it's really scary. It can cause you just to throw your hands up and be like, I'm done.
Well, here's a little bit of a hot take though. Like, I think it's more than that for in my mind. Like, I think a lot of people do PSLF because they think they got to get a plan and that's their out. That's the path. I'm thinking about this a little bit in terms of our physician clients, because it's not some people that if you want to be a social worker, you're probably working at a not-for-profit or government employer, just period, right? But if you're a physician, for example, you have a choice. You can go not-for-profit, you can work in the private sector. And I think a lot of people assume wrongly that my only path out from this terrifying loan problem that I got is I got to go get PSLF at a nonprofit employer. If that makes sense. So like, I think sometimes people buy it too much.
Yeah, I guess it can. But like for a high net worth, we're assuming that a doctor is going to be a high income individual, but that's not always true across specialties. But if you're someone staring at $300,000, $400,000, $500,000 worth of debt, then PSLF makes a lot of sense as your way out, especially if you know your income is going to increase drastically once you hit your intending years. And so, yeah, it makes sense. But if you're someone who's like, in a profession where, oh, I'm going to make $100,000 a year and I still owe $500,000 for my education, then maybe PSLF is the best way. Or maybe income-driven repayment actually works out as well, too. It just takes 2.5 times longer or 2 times long, depending on the plan you're in.
Well, yeah. I mean, like, I'm thinking about, like, some people that are in primary care that felt like they had to go upend their lives to go find a 10-year eligible employer where like new IBR might be a viable option still, like going for the 20-year forgiveness.
But who is that individual? How many for that person? And because I imagine you're speaking to like a cohort of borrowers that fit that kind of profile. Sure. How much do they typically owe and like how much are they typically earning?
I mean, you might have somebody owing $400,000 that earns maybe 150 to 225, something like that. I mean, for the lower income primary care docs, you know,
but they're in a position where they owe 2.5-3 times more than what they bring in on an annual basis. So their only clear path out is forgiveness.
They're going for forgiveness either way.
Right, PSLF or IDR.
Yeah.
And so do you need to actually upend your life to go to public practice or can you just stay private if you wanted to?
Sure. You can, yeah. Well, I mean, and that's what I'm saying. Like in terms of, I think what I see every day is people have more options than they think they got. And I think that's exciting for people to know that, you know, you have choices in some of this. Like I'll give you an example that most people have choices. Not everybody, I should say that. Some people do not have choices. They have limited options. But a lot of the people that listen to our show tend to be more of those like grad degree, professional degree holding folks that have higher than average incomes. I should acknowledge that. I mean, I just to tell you one story like that really stands out to me. I remember talking to this dentist couple. They were going to get married. They tried to get that FQHC benefit. And to do that, they got a job, but one of them had to go like 2 hours south. One of them had to go 2 hours north. And they lived in the middle of their two practices and they were driving through like sleet and ice and snow half the year doing this FQHC employer. And it's like, yo, did you realize that you could just go for forgiveness with pay and like you don't have to get PSLF? And it's like not that crazy. Like it's not that dissimilar. And like you're driving this 2 hour drive for like not a lot of reason. And they were just like, you hear a pin drop, you know? And yeah, so that's what
it is, right? Because like it goes back to like, why is there even a need for a you or for me in this space? Because there's so many different rules and kind of so many different things. it is necessarily a full-time job to understand all of those things to be able to balance out and then take those rules and apply them to your individual situation and your goals and say what's right for you. I imagine they talk to you and they're like, wait, I don't have to do this. I don't have to suffer through this. No, you don't have to do that at all. And that comes up time and time again where people have a belief of what their choices are, what their options are, that actually does not comport with reality. And that has been kind of like emphasized even more over the last 5 years with the number of changes that we've seen, that there's new information that's been put into the system and people aren't adapting to it. And then they're like, they missed out on the one-time account adjustment. They missed out on the limited PS left waiver because they were operating with one set of belief that none of this stuff applies to me, so I'm just going to ignore it and I have to do it this way, which is sad, but I understand how people get there.
Well, if I can take a little bit of a detour, here's a real interesting, spicy question. Do you think with these new loan limits that there will be a place for people like you and me long term? Let's just throw that out there, because I think it's really interesting what's happening, right? The loan limits are getting capped at $50,000 a year for professional school, $20,500 for grad school. That's not going to take into effect, though, right away. You know, people that are already in a program are going to get to borrow the max until they're completed with their degree. So I guess, like, basically people that are first years right now that are graduating in 2029, those people are going to be able to max everything out. But then starting in the class of 2030, you're going to have people coming out and most people are going to have that $50,000 per year kind of borrowing amount. What are your thoughts on the future of student loan advice? I thought that might be kind of interesting.
I think it changes in terms of how you balance it all, because now the choice between federal and private is going to be quite high, especially for this long tail of borrowers who already have loans that are going to be deeply harmed if they take out a new loan after 2026, June 30th, 2026, where they're considered a new borrower, and they drastically reduce their options, especially for those who have Parent PLUS loans. Because if they borrow a new loan after that date, they lose all access to IBR and they don't have access to RAP, so they have no income-based option. So I think there's that part, there's that group. Then there's the new group of new borrowers who are trying to weigh out, how do I actually fund this education? And then there are going to be people who take out private student loans to kind of cover that gap. And then their outcome is not going to be, after they graduate, where they have the ability to pay off those private student loans. Now they have to figure out, okay, what do I do? Do I refinance? Do I strategically default here? How do I handle this? And that's another cohort that needs advisement. So I don't see it going away, because we are a system that is built on taking out this debt to pay for education. And if you're taking out debt, then you're always going to want someone that knows the system better than you to kind of help guide you along the way.
At the risk of sounding self-serving, like, I do think there's going to be a place for student loan advice, like, after 2030, because how long have we been doing this? Like, we know this stuff changes all the time, right? And so I'm thinking about these rules that we've got in place now. If a different party wins the White House in 2028 and they've got leverage to make some changes, they're going to make some changes, right? Like, I mean, $50,000 loan limits is low.
I don't know how you're going to pay for education long term with the rules set as they are. Now, people say, oh, there's going to be consolidation. The market is going to take care of itself.
Not in a recession.
I don't know that's the case, right?
Yeah.
So this is a long, long life and things are going to change over time. And so I think what we see lying ahead of us is very scary with PSLF, with the changes to borrowing, especially if you're someone who is currently borrowing for their child's education or borrowing for your own education. It can get really spooky very fast. But I also think that, as you said, new administration comes in, whether party, different party, whatever, there's going to have to adapt because there's going to be a crisis that pops up that we must answer, which is how a lot of these rules change over time anyways. We're responding to a crisis. We got income-based repayment because they're like, oh, shoot, income contingent rent payment is too expensive. No one can afford it. Okay, new plan. Well, nope, income-based repayment, still too expensive. Okay, new plan, pay as you earn.
Yeah.
Nope, pay as you earn is too expensive. Here comes save, new plan.
I mean, I think of this as my earlier life as a bond trader, right? Like, if you cap out loans like this, you got $50,000 a year, and then you have a recession. What happens in a recession is liquidity dries up, lenders don't want to lend, and the lenders that do lend have to charge a huge risk premium to give out the cash. So you might be going from 8% student loans to 15% student loans, and that's if you can get one at all.
You're going 8 to 15% as a prime borrower, right? We have 15% right now for subprime, but then the prime market is just, it's going to get bad, and then we're going to respond to it.
Well, and then, yeah, the government will have to make a choice of, do you want nobody to go to dental, medical, or vet school during this recession, or do you change the rules? I do think that anybody who's got a huge amount of federal loans that feels a little despondent about their options, you know, anybody who's already a borrower has got some decent options, not nearly as good as save, right? But like decent options that should not bankrupt you with careful planning, like filing separately, still a thing, maxing out retirement accounts. If you're eligible for new IBR, being on that, you know, if you're not and the IBR plan is the only option, hopefully you maybe are old enough to have built up some equity in your retirement and your home in some savings. If not, there's still some things you can do, right? So I'm hopeful on existing borrowers, I think, are going to be okay, especially with good guidance. I think they're going to be in good shape, at least not terrible shape for most people. Well, most people, okay, let me cohort that. The most people that listen to this podcast that are professionals with, I always have to kind of think about that because there's a whole different group of student loan borrowers. It's a very different financial state that's not kind of who we tend to serve at Student Loan Planner.
Well, and yeah, and that's where like it's always interesting because the way that you enter into the market you serve is different from who I serve. There is some overlap inside of that Venn diagram, but there's definitely like I deal with people who may not make more than $50,000 in a year, and they still owe $100,000, $200,000 of debt, and they're trying to figure it out. But you're right that for existing borrowers, they have a greater kind of payment options to choose from and solutions there. And yes, save is gone, and it's not coming back because who's going to keep it around? But for the most part, wrap IBR, careful management, jump through enough hoops, we can find a way to get to a manageable monthly payment for the vast majority of people.
Could I say, though,
jump through so many hoops, though.
Could I say real quick, though, I'm going to do a hot take. If a Democrat wins the White House in 2028, this might be too hot of a take, but I think save comes back. I think the way it comes back is I think they do the same legislative process that Republicans just did. I think they increase loan limits. I think they reintroduce the save plan through legislation. Now, that's, of course, if the Democrats get the Senate.
I was reading this article in the Washington Post about this aristocracy kind of pushed by tech titans, man. So it's a very scary world to be in, man.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, that's just a random like thought. Like, I don't know. I might be totally off on that. But I mean,
well, at least for now, save is dead.
For now, yeah. Like then until 2029 at the earliest. You know, to be fair, it's still dead if Republicans hold either the House or the Senate because they're not going to like change that legislation, which basically blocks, you know, Secretary of Education from coming out with these new plans. I think that you can say that it's dead unless there's a Democratic sweep in 2028, which we've seen crazier things happen. I mean, I know people feel a little, you know, on the Democratic side, probably feel a little bit despondent at the moment, but the pendulum swings, right? The student loan pendulum swings over time. And so I seriously doubt this set of rules is going to be the student loan set of rules that we're going to have for the next 10 years.
I agree with you, but that's actually leads to an interesting thing because we wanted to pivot into kind of save plan. And
yeah,
your kind of hypothesis or what you're throwing out there right now is that if Democrats take the midterm, which is next year, right? Like if they mm-hmm. take midterms, then there's a stronger chance of save surviving come 2028. And so if we do timeline-wise, save is likely going to be gone, or it's supposed to be sunset no later than 2028. However, mm-hmm. it can be moved up timeline-wise. And I think that it'll probably end at the same time RAP comes online, which RAP is supposed to have come online before June 30th, 2026. Is it possible that everyone in SAVE can be kicked out of it before midterms even take place?
Well, it's interesting timing, right? So if you're thinking about, man, I really wish SAVE would come back, what are the chances? I mean, like, I would look in the midterms and see, do Democrats flip the North Carolina seat, hold on to the Georgia seat, right? Do they take the House? And then in 2028, do they make a little more progress? And then do they have the votes to do budget reconciliation on their stuff, and student loans will be a part of it, I'm sure of that, if they did have all three levers there. But I mean, yeah, we should probably pivot to the now instead of speculation. So like the SAVE plan getting phased out, some people are on pay, that's getting phased out. There's a lot of confusion right now about what do I do, right? Like I'm getting bills in the mail, being told I have to make payments again. And a lot of people are just doubting everything, right? Like some people have 2027 recertification dates for some of this stuff. So people just don't know what to do. You know, what would you tell people that are dealing with this save forbearance pay uncertainty right now?
What we do, and when we get like those bills in for clients, those statements, we call the servicer to confirm exactly what's happening because there is confusion because some of those bills and letters are just being auto-generated, right? And they don't necessarily bear a clear reflection of what's happening on your account. As soon as that letter comes in, we're calling into the servicer and we're basically asking the same questions on repeat. What is my current repayment plan that I'm in? What is my due date for that plan? What is the payment amount? What is the recertification date that you show in the system for those, right? And we just want to confirm that. We want to check back in as letters come in because sometimes there is going to just be this conflicting information, especially because there was a change in recertification date that impacted different groups, which can make it really hard to manage as a MOHELA, as a Nelnet, as an Ed Financial Aid Vantage. So I can understand why the errors exist. They shouldn't exist, but I understand how they get there. So I think it's important to just go back and ask those questions every time. What repayment plan am I in? What's my amount? What's my due date? What's my recertification date? Because if we know those things, you know, then we should be good because they should be able to pull it right from that system and check and confirm.
Some people still have these 2027 dates, like recertification for IDR. And I get people reaching out like, can I trust February 2027? You know, can I trust that date? Like,
well, trust it as to what? That it won't be any sooner or
sure
be later? Like, what? How are we asking trust there?
Maybe both, because I guess what people are dealing with as borrowers, right, is those recertification dates have been moved over and over and over and over again. And people are just confused, like, do I actually have to recertify when my servicer tells me? Can I push
but
it
that's
off?
Not really, I don't know if that's really the problem, though. Do I have to recertify when they tell me? Or is it more, I am waiting to make a life decision about how to file my taxes or take time off from work or whatever so I can work to get a lower payment when it is time to recertify?
Yeah. So the way I'm thinking about this, I guess, is like, go ahead and do the right thing overall that makes the most sense. And so what I mean by that is like, if you're on safe forbearance and you're trying to get PSLF, you might as well get on IBR. You might as well get on IBR and get the payment count going.
It depends though, right? Because like, let's say the payment amount that you have under save is super low because you were in residency year, chief year, whatever, right? And fellowship. Then your income now is an attending income. Would you be better served to just ride out the save plan forbearance and use buyback for that period down the road? Or do you want to start accruing credit right away at this higher monthly payment amount?
Well, I mean, here's my question, right? If you look at the buyback rule, say forbearance is longer than a year, which basically all the saved forbearances have been longer than a year, they're allowed to look in the year in question and not use the lower of the two payments before or after. They're allowed to ask for tax returns. So if they can ask for tax returns anyway, will they? I don't know. I mean, like, will that even be around in three, four
years? And that's really a tough question. It's like, do I actually trust buyback to be there available for me once I hit the 10-year mark?
Yeah.
And then if I trust it to be there, what actually will they look at for that period of time income-wise?
And I don't think it will be. I mean, I think that they're going to do maybe a second round of regulations at some point, maybe post-midterms, where they want to leave their mark on higher ed policy, right? And so you go bigger, right? Because what is the only thing holding them back from going bigger on some of these types of policies? It's the midterm, you know, maybe, I don't know. I mean, that's probably like giving it too much credit, but I don't know. I think that they could go bigger and, you know, eliminating PSLF buyback because it's not legislation, right? You know, they might just be like, this is so much work to maintain this and to, you know, make this program available. This just isn't worth it. So I don't know. I mean, I guess the way I think about it, Stanley, is like, if somebody can ask for your tax return from that year, well, then if you're an attending and your prior year tax return is that resident income, well, then you could just get onto IBR now and go ahead and make use, guaranteed use of that low income tax year from the prior year to get onto IBR before you have to file your new one. So I guess I think about it in the sense of like, go with the bird in hand that you know versus the one that you don't, as long as it won't cost you.
No, and I agree with you as well. And there's also something to be said about the forward momentum of it all too,
right?
Which is, I am now making progress instead of stuck in this kind of limbo. There's value in that. And I don't want to discount that at all, but it is also fair to say that there are people actually having that kind of that weighing out of choices. And some people are choosing just to stay and save for as long as possible and hoping to be able to use buyback at a much lower amount. But there are all these considerations that we aren't quite clear at exactly how it's going to play out.
You know who I feel is like getting hit in the mouth right now, like hardest, is, well, I mean, in terms of relatively speaking among our group of people, is the 35 to 45 year olds and then like the Parent Plus folks. So like what I mean by that is there's a cohort of people that's not pay eligible, right? Their only option is old IBR. And if you look at those payments, like And they're also like kind of far into their IDR forgiveness. Like they're maybe like 10 to 15 years into their IDR forgiveness too. Like I got an email the other day from like this veterinarian who's making $200,000 a year, which is a good income, but she's in a high cost of living area in the Northeast. And she's like, oh my gosh, like my payment is like $2,500 a month or something like that. I'm just thinking about that. And it's like, well, you people might say, oh, you know, Cry Me a River, $200K income is a nice income. But it's like, okay, well, after taxes and stuff, you're probably like maybe $10,000 a month, maybe $11,000 a month. And you've got your mortgage, which in a high cost living area with high property taxes is probably four, right? And then you've got your car payment, your kids' nanny payment and stuff. And now you've got to pay almost $3,000 a month for student loans to keep your forgiveness clock running. So I think people are kind of getting hit with sticker shock after years of like pushing off on the certifications and also the save plan, which was more generous, you know.
Well, and not just, but it's not just the loss of save, it's also the loss of repay, right?
Sure.
So yeah. Now you're going back to a 2007 rule for IDR, right, that we accounted for in like whenever repay was passed, I don't think it was like 2015 or something like that, where we said, hey, we need a solution because IDR just isn't affordable for that group of people, especially if you are someone single, high earner, high cost of living area, and you are maybe leveraged in ways. And people, again, there's all type of criticism to make, oh, you know, you should know better about this. But that's not necessarily how life works, and it's not how these deals work. But,
and if you think about tax rate, like, I mean, if you kind of sum it all up, like somebody who's making about 160K, if you think about IBR, like their marginal tax rate basically is like 24 federal, I think, something like that. And then let's say it's six states. Now you're at 30, and then layer on FICA, which is about, you know, 7.6 or something like that, right? So now, so you're at 37, 38, you know, layer on 15 for IBR. What am I at? Like 53, something like that? I mean, 52, 53%. I mean, that's like more than European levels of taxation without the European level of like services and healthcare and stuff like that, right? So I think like, you know, if somebody that's criticizing somebody from being quote unquote over leveraged, it's like, wait a second, you don't get a discount on daycare services, or maybe if there are state programs, you're probably not qualifying for them if you're making that kind of income level, but you're also not making so much money that you're like super wealthy. It's just challenging for a lot of people.
And there's a mathematical reason to feel very sympathetic for like the 35 to 45 year old group, just because like, yeesh, payments in the side of bars you described. But there's also very much so an emotional reason to feel for them, because you did everything right. And it doesn't feel like it when you look at like how you're living and the stress that you're under, because yeah, that $200,000 job comes with a lot of freaking responsibility oftentimes.
And stress.
And yeah, stress that comes with it. And then you look at your ability to do certain things, and I don't get to just go on these random vacations and live this great life. It doesn't work like that. It makes you almost feel like, man, maybe I shouldn't even done this thing. Maybe I should have done something else and not taken out this thing. And that's a very sad place to be at, where you should, like, man, I did what I was supposed to do, and yet I'm being penalized. As you pointed out, the math, 53% overall tax rate, once you factor in the payment, it's just wild.
It's brutal. At some point too, you jump up to 32% bracket, and then the FICA stuff goes down some, but you know, but it's still pretty brutal. I mean, I guess like thinking about Parent Plus two people just briefly for a moment too, because I just want to acknowledge them. They are really set up for a trap right now. If you have a couple kids in school as freshmen or sophomores, right? Like let's say they're at some expensive school. I think you get grandfathered in for them to be able to finish the Parent Plus borrowing.
Yeah, but
for the 3-year rule.
But if you keep borrowing, you lose access to income-based repayment options.
So we're setting up all these Parent Plus folks for, you know, essentially having to make a choice between, this is kind of almost literally a choice between them being able to retire and their kids finishing out their school. And like, I've thought about this a little bit, and it's like, for people who are borrowing Parent Plus after 2026, like if you're borrowing under the old rules with the uncapped stuff, it's almost more smart if you're more modest income to just default and pay the 15% if they garnish you. Tell me if that's crazy.
No, it's not crazy. Like everything feels crazy until like you're in the moment and you're trying to decide what's the most rational decision I can do given all the facts that I have. I was actually looking at my phone because there was a client I met with earlier this week, single mom, three kids, one kid just graduated college, went to the school that he wanted to. And she's dealing with his private student loans, which are like $160,000. And we're like, okay, cool. We need to consolidate these, get them into IBR, and then do that. And that monthly payment on those loans, she can make it if we kind of do some things to tweak with her AGI. She can make it if she really needs his help, but he can't find a job right
those
now.
Those are Parent Plus, though? Is that
those Parent Plus? Those are Parent Plus loans. Yeah.
Okay.
Those are Parent Plus loans, just Parent Plus loans. She had her loans forgiven through PSLF. She works in the school system.
Okay.
But she has these Parent Plus loans, and he's not able to help with it. It's all her responsibility. We can get there. But then she still has two more kids that are juniors in high school that she needs to be able to pay for their education as well. And she's trying to have that conversation now about, hey, you can't go to the school of your dreams like your brother did. You have to choose a state school that I can actually afford. And having a conversation where watching her heart break because she can't provide for him the same way. And then she's like, I do well. I make almost $200,000 a year. But she lives in New York.
Single
mom of three.
Yeah.
And I'm telling her, if you take out another Parent Plus loan, not only do you further endanger yourself financially and able to kind of pay your bills, but you also lose access to income-driven repayment on the loans for you borrow for your son's education, which further complicates your situation. And then leading to your point, could it then be a rational decision for her to just default and say, just take 15% because it's actually cheaper than what she would pay overall? Sure. But then what does that leave her? That leaves her with...
So I guess if I was talking... Yeah, I mean, if I'm talking to her, I think I like... One of the tricks I learned in counseling is like, try to empower yourself and figure out a way to reframe things as things not happening to you, but like you having agency, even if it's not great choices, but at least you regain some control over the situation, right?
Yeah.
So I guess like one thought process on this for her would be like to say, well, let's apply all those same places anyway. All the schools you want to go to, there's nothing that says you can't apply to those schools. We just have to look at the reality of things before we sign on the dotted line. And then what you could do is you could become an aggressive negotiator with the group, and that might not work, right? But you could still do asking for professional, unless it's like one of the schools that just doesn't negotiate at all. There's some of those. But most of those schools out there will offer some kind of like merit aid and discounted tuitions. Like if you negotiate with their aid office and have aid offers you can leverage from other places that are like similar schools to those schools, right?
Right. But look at the job that just changed, right? Because the job with the first student was, oh, I just need to sign out and take out this loan.
Sure.
And
sure,
the job
sure.
with the other ones are like, I have to become a negotiator.
Well, I know. And that's not realistic for some people. But it's like what I'm saying is if she's getting the professional advice from one of us or something, right? It's kind of like, you know, like Ron Lieber has a good online course for like $100-something that you can take to teach you how to negotiate with like the schools. So that's just a thought that I have. And, you know, like they could also look into okay, maybe the choice is ROTC scholarships or some other scholarships for the school where maybe it's a choice between, okay, you can go to NC State and just go and just have a great time and not have to be committed to any kind of service obligation or something. Or you can go to Vanderbilt and do, you know, ROTC there and the military will pay for it. But the catch is you got to serve in the military. That's not nearly as the way it was. Like, I guess I would be wondering, is there a way to slow down the sadness over losing those options by saying, maybe we should at least try and then like see all of our options before fully giving up and saying, yeah, the only choice is state school. You got to go there.
Absolutely. You're right to point out there are different ways to get to Damascus, right? We can take different roads to get there. But you have to first kind of deal with, oh, shoot, the way I thought about it changed overnight. Now,
it
should have changed because like Parent Plus loan system is kind of crazy when you think about it. We give out loans that have no kind of like association with the ability to pay it back. And so, yeah, I don't think that's a sustainable system. And it's something that did just change on the fly and change midstream for people as well. And there's a kind of a part where we got to deal with that first. And then we can move into, okay, now that we've done that, what are all our universal options here?
Can I tell you what I think is going to happen? I think the average SAT score, a lot of these schools is going to plummet. And let me tell you why. I think that the schools are going to have to face reality too. Like, I think if the school can't put the parent in like unlimited Parent Plus loans, the school has got to decide if we want to have
Lower our standards and increase our.
Well, I mean, so what you could do is you could price discriminate more, right? And you could allow that single mom of three to get a better deal on tuition, but then accept a little bit more of a mix of full pay students off the wait list that normally wouldn't get in, that if their parents are willing to shell out full price, maybe you make an exception or maybe you expand your class size a little bit. Like, I think universities are wanting to exist, right? They want to not close their doors. It's going to be so much dislocation in the marketplace the next couple of years because you're just going to have mass confusion, mass moves, there's going to be different universities trying out different things. And I guess I would wonder if that same school that gave her the Parent Plus loan, the $160K, I seriously wonder if that school is going to face reality. And that school might say, you know what, sorry, we just want full pay students. Or the school could say, well, because we want to still have students from different socioeconomic backgrounds, like maybe we have to get a little bit more creative with how we price stuff. I don't know. Maybe I'm just full of it, but you know, that's my wondering.
I don't know. We need more University of Austin at Texas to pop up where no one pays for school. We all just fund it back in the future.
Yeah, I don't know, man. But it would be interesting to see. I mean, so I do think that a fair criticism of universities is they haven't tried to be like as innovative as they could be in terms of like expanding access. Why does Harvard need to have 6,000 students or whatever, or whatever number they have, right? Like, why do some of these schools have to try to reject so many people so they can have their hikes, you know, low acceptance rate so they can show up high in the US news rankings or whatever, right? So I kind of wonder if some of these caps, if there's any silver lining. I guess I hope that some of these more affordable programs would recognize that they have the capacity to serve more students affordably and that they would react to the demand by like doing that. But I don't know. That's maybe wishful thinking because Grad Plus, it basically made it a revenue opportunity for all of these schools to open up and pop up. And Parent Plus made it a revenue opportunity to attract all these students from out of state that you could just load up with Parent Plus and get a bunch of money for the school. So I guess that's what I'm kind of wondering is like some of the schools are very much for-profit motivated and they want to make money. And then some of the other schools are more like bureaucracy motivated and like do whatever like the state rules or state tells them to do. So I don't know. It'd be interesting to see how it shakes out.
Yeah, I mean, no matter what system you go into, there's going to be gamification of it to take advantage of those rules inside of it. So I want to be very clear, like a lot of things that came through One Big Beautiful Bill, even though they may have disastrous impacts on some group of people, something needs to change with this system. Yeah. I don't know if these were the right changes, but I don't know what the right answer is either, other than recognizing that higher education is a public utility that we all benefit from. And so we should all share the cost equally. And that is the right solution, in my opinion. But I don't see us ever getting there where we just say college is free for everyone. We struggle to say community college is free for people.
If I could have made one big change in the bill, it would have been higher loan limits for people that have financial need. Like you don't want to give guaranteed federal loans with interest subsidies to families that are wealthy. But it would have been really nice to try to have like higher loan limits so that people from low income backgrounds can still access med school.
Either higher loan limits or we actually increase those need based grants, scholarships, right? Which we haven't done and like hasn't kept pace with it. So we are going to see the loss of color and diversity in our classrooms unless something's moving forward. And I don't know that that's good for our overall economy if that happens, where we see that type of attrition.
You know, I have to apologize to NYU because I said when they made their medical school free, I was like, man, what a dumb idea because like you can just get PSLF anyway and like you're just throwing money away. But then look, they were smarter than me. They already projected that all this was going to happen. The PSLF was going to get capped. Now who's laughing, right? So I don't know. We'll probably see very limited growth of those kind of programs.
I want to clear something up that you just said. You said PSLF is capped and I don't want anybody freaking out. What do you mean by
Okay. Yeah. The future of PSLF will have a basically long-term, not any time for people that are existing borrowers. Thanks for making me clarify. For future borrowers that have not borrowed yet, they're going to borrow after July 2026. They will have a borrowing limit of $50,000 per year over 4 years for like med school. That's $200K plus accrued interest. So that just means that the max value of PSLF because of loan caps is just going to have a max potential benefit based off of like the amount of loans you can take out isn't unlimited anymore. So that's what I meant. Thank you for clarifying that.
No, absolutely. We don't want to freak people out. I can just see the comments coming right away.
Travis just said PSLF. Oh my gosh. You know? So one more thing. So they're doing negotiated rulemaking right now. They're coming out with some new regulations or thinking about it. They're trying to clarify some things in the One Big Beautiful Bill. Is there anything you're concerned about with those regulations or anything you're kind of monitoring that you want people to be aware of?
No, not as of yet. Actually, like what I am waiting for is to see more clarification about how we're going to handle family size and marital filing status for RAP borrowers, because it's unclear, is it just going to be dependents claimed on tax return or we're going to have a much more expansive view family size, because we have these dynamic families that don't necessarily always correspond with who I'm claiming on my taxes. And so that additional credit for family size can really be helpful for people in lowering the monthly payment, especially under IBR for that category. And then how we're going to handle married borrowers who both have student loans but file separately, how are their payments going to be calculated? So that's what I'm really interested to see exactly how that plays out. There hasn't been much talk about that. It's really been about PSLF so far, but that's what I'm really interested in.
Yeah, man, it's going to be interesting to see all the stuff fill in. I mean, I guess I'm kind of surprised. Like, it seems like they're taking some of the more maybe like center think tanks, like, you know, points into view on these negotiated rulemaking. Like, there's a person that has proposed a more reasonable definition for loan limits that would include PA programs and, you know, NP programs, yeah, and the 50K max loan limits instead of the 20,000 a year. So, I mean, that's kind of cool when you accept, kind of were thinking something was not going to be very generous and it ends up being a little bit more generous. So that was good to see. So I'm hopeful for negotiated rulemaking that, like, those rules that when they get published won't be crazy, won't have too much to update people on.
It's dramatic. And there was this all this like, rap is bad, rap is bad, rap is bad. But I think as we've slowly gotten into it, like, okay, it's not terrible. And there's actually some huge benefits for people under the right scenarios, but we still need more information to properly weigh out what the right choice for a borrower would be in the long term. I think what is interesting is right now in the rulemaking, it appears that you can enroll in RAP, get credit for the time in RAP, and then go back to IBR and use that credit towards your forgiveness path, which is interesting to me because RAP comes with this benefit of the interest subsidy and a waiver. I'm sorry, the contribution towards principal. So theoretically, someone can go into RAP, have their interest waived during that time, and then jump back into IBR at the earliest forgiveness timeline. I don't think that's going to stand, but that's where it's at today.
Well, yeah, there's all these like things that got to get filled in with the details. And I don't think, you know, even if they accidentally let something slip, they still have another bite at the apple, right? Like, that's why
exactly.
I'm thinking.
It's just one of those things I look at it just seems wild that that would even exist, because
right,
the whole point of that benefit is to pay for five more years. But if I can apply this credit to IBR, why wouldn't I do that?
Yeah, I don't think they're going to let that stand. But I mean, I was also surprised to see that they're thinking about letting people have access to IBR that are existing borrowers even after that 2026 date. Like, you could switch between them potentially. Like, I mean, that was kind of unexpected for me to see them talking about being able to switch between plans for existing borrowers. Like, we have to wait and see on that, because like the idea is kind of like, I mean, I think what they were trying to do with the bill is to sort of be like, you know, after 2026, everybody's locked in, rap or bust.
That was a talk.
Like,
that was the talking points, right?
Yeah, that was the talking points. So, but we have to actually see what that's why you can't just trust the talking points. You actually have to read the regulations, see what the regs say, and the regs, when they're not matching the talking points, you got to go with what the regs say, because that's what the regs will say. Yeah, and that's what the rules are.
That brings it to like ending this. It's always funny. Like, I was looking at Reddit threads and everything like that, just trying to figure out some questions that people were having, and then you see people are like, oh man, you know, it would be nice if these attorneys and advisors can just say what the answer is. And you're like, dude, there's so much of this stuff that, like, it's unclear what the actual answer is.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
And like, so I'm with you. I wish we could tell you straight up, this is how it's going to work. And when it's clear like that, you will see us all in alignment on those things. But with what's happening right now, there's still so much that is unclear. Example I was thinking of is, like, we didn't have clarity on how someone who reached IDR forgiveness in 2025, how it was actually going to be handled if it wasn't actually applied until 2026. We could clearly read the reg say the identifiable event, once it occurred, it should be looked at that way, but there was still not enough clarification until the joint report came out and said, this is what we're doing, right? So, I wish we could provide clarity all the time, but sometimes all we can do is think through the thing and say, here's where we're at right now based off of what we know.
Well, and like all this stuff goes into effect, a lot of it July 2026, and then you can't switch into the pay plan, I think, after July 2027. And then there's some stuff that goes into effect like 2028 and then 2029. But then the people who are going to be most impacted by these loan caps are going to be graduating into a world where, well, we might have a different president. We will have a different president. Even President Trump has said he's not running for a third term, LOL. But like, I mean, you know, but I'm,
you
mean,
know, but
like,
then it adds to that point. It's like, what does running mean? I never said I wouldn't say.
But you know, what I meant is just, you might have a Democratic president, you might have Republican, but who knows, right? Who knows what the future holds? But we can think about the past. It's not a guarantee of the future, but it's probably likely that the past in some ways might repeat itself at some point, right? Which is more generous loan rules might happen again at some point. The only thing we know is that these loan rules are going to be in place until the end of the Trump administration. We know that. So
exactly.
Well, it's excellent having you on, Stanley. It's such a treat every time. Where again is the spot for them to follow your spot you wanted to follow?
Ah, man, they could just come over to the YouTube channel, catch us there, or come over to tadsq.com and sign up for the newsletter. We'll be sure to give them all the information they need there.
Yeah.
Travis, absolute pleasure. It's always cool because you come at this from a totally different mindset than I do in a different audience. So I really appreciate how you think about things.
That's why it's like the more the merrier, right? Because it's like you approach it from that more lawyer detailed rule knowledge. And I tend to approach it a little bit more from that math financial planning kind of lens. And a little bit more, niche audience, right? Like people that we're serving that are a little bit different, the professional borrowers with the six-figure balances. But there's so many people out there that need help. It's going to be a lot to help them. And so we need as many people like us, hopefully out there helping people as possible for the changes that are coming down.
Yeah, bro. I'm taking away that 53% math that you were doing once you factor in the student loan payment as part of like a tax payment as well. I hadn't thought about it in just like that. So I appreciate that.
Yeah. Stanley, thanks so much. And everybody, thank you for listening to Student Loan Planner Podcast, and I hope you have a great rest of your week. Are you on the free Student Loan Planner email list? If yes, you can upgrade your experience and discover student loan loopholes so good, they might get repealed if I talk about them publicly. Find out my very best thought leadership that I really just can't be super open about anymore, unfortunately. If you want to get our very best tips, not just the ones that I can share for free, go to studentloanplanner.com/insider to get a special discount for your year membership. That's studentloanplanner.com/insider and get our very best dozens of bonus content and tips that's going to save you money and get you out of student debt faster. And if you're already an SLP insider, please reply back to those emails and let me know how I can make it even more valuable.